Welcome, everyone, to this episode of the Lengervam podcast. Today, I welcome Patrick Kendrick, who joins us from Lisbon. Hello, Patrick. How are you?
Hi, Alex. I'm very well. Yourself?
We just talked about the weather, which is obviously much nicer in Lisbon than it is in Brussels. But you seem to be bouncing back and forth between several places, actually. You're from the UK.
I am.
Your professional domicile is in Italy, I think, but at the moment you're in Portugal.
Yes, that's correct. I'm originally from Winchester in the south of England, but I was previously based in Milan for work, and I moved to Lisbon in the middle of March. And as such, as an interpreter, we're required to have a professional domicile, as I'm sure many of your listeners know. And I decided to keep mine in Milan as opposed to moving it to Lisbon for a number of reasons, really. So, as a result, when I'm called for work in Milan, I travel from here, and occasionally I go to the UK for work as well. So it's quite nice. I get to travel with my job.
Which we like to do, obviously.
Absolutely.
So your working languages at the moment are English, Italian, and you're working on Portuguese, is that right?
I'm an English mother tongue, and I work with French and Italian, and I'm in the very early stages, the embryonic stage of learning Portuguese with a view to hopefully adding that one day to my linguistic combination, but I think that's some way down the track. But yeah, currently I work with French and Italian.
Do you have a favourite football club?
I do, yeah. My team is Southampton back in England, which is great because we qualified for European football for this season for the first time in over a decade.
Well, congratulations.
Yeah, thank you very much. Well, congratulate the team and the management more than me, but I'm hoping that as such, Southampton draw a French or an Italian speaking team, because then I'll get to work at the press conferences, which is a bit of a dream of mine to work with my club. So fingers crossed for the draw. Well, first of all, we have to get past a Danish opponent this week and then the following week, and then there'll be a draw at the end of August in which we might have a chance of coming up against the likes of Bordeaux or Saint-Etienne or perhaps an Italian team, Fiorentina maybe. So yeah.
It's not too bad, yeah. I think the way it works in the UK, at least I heard this from John Oliver, the comedian, is I think you sort of inherit your favourite club from your dad, or I don't know, it's just where you grow up. Is that how it works?
Yeah, more or less. I came to mine a bit late. Well, I probably shouldn't admit this on air because I'll get a lot of stick from my friends. But yeah,
we cut this out.
I grew up. I grew up the first 12 years of my life in a place called Weybridge, which is just outside London, and there aren't too many big football teams nearby. You get the London clubs, but you have no real affinity with them. So geographically, there was nothing to go on. I used to play in goal, and there was a Danish goalkeeper for Manchester United, Peter Schmeichel, who there was a minor resemblance in that he had a shock of white blonde hair, and as did I as a kid, and I played in goal. So someone once compared me to him, he instantly became my hero, and I became a Manchester United fan. That wasn't until I was 12, and my dad moved the family down to Southampton for work. He was working in Southampton. We moved to Winchester, which is just down the road, and I went to a Southampton game about a year later, and gradually became a Southampton fan. And now, I'm a big fan, albeit officially we're not supposed to have any loyalties. But as I'm not covering English football at this moment in time, I think I'm free to tweet the occasional thing about Southampton.
Yeah,
that's my main outlet. Yeah,
I should probably point out right now that you are not only an interpreter but also a sports, or more precisely, a football commentator.
We are back, 85 days on since our last broadcast in English here on BTV. We bring you live coverage from the opening weekend of Liga NOS 2015-2016, Benfica against Estoril.
Which explains why we're talking about football so much. Now, I'm not a huge football expert, as you will probably recognize throughout the podcast, but I'm doing my best. But maybe let's start off with this question. When you go to a cocktail party or to some event and people ask you what you do for a living, would you introduce yourself as a sports commentator or as an interpreter?
Yeah, that's something I've pondered actually quite a lot, because I tend to my answer tends to change based on who I'm speaking to.
And it's difficult to explain what an interpreter does, because everybody knows what a sports commentator does. But with interpreters, you have to explain the difference between the interpreter and the translator and everything. So, yeah, that will make sense, I think.
Exactly. I tend to find that it depends what mood I'm in. If I know that I'm with someone who is likely to be a fan of football, then I typically say I'm an interpreter because I don't really want to talk shop all evening. But equally, if I know that I'm in a very multilingual environment, then I tend to say I'm a sports commentator for that reason. And also, there's a lot of misconceptions, I think, about interpreters as well, that we are naturally bi or trilingual, which isn't really the case for most of us. So if you're in a multilingual environment, sometimes you're with people who are bi and trilingual. And then, I don't know, I find there tends to be a bit of awkwardness with someone else who doesn't really understand the dynamic. And they might start to say, oh, well, so-and-so speaks these languages, they could do it. I'd rather not get onto that conversation. So I think it depends. The one thing that I never say I am, which is probably a bad thing, and I think there's... I never really say I'm a translator, which is actually the bulk of my income every month. So that's probably because of when I did my training, there seemed to be this sort of inherent snobbery from the interpreters towards the translators, which I didn't want to pick up, but perhaps I have subconsciously, or maybe, I don't know, translator is not quite as sexy a title as commentator or interpreter, so I don't know.
I think many of us do that subconsciously, but it's terrible. I mean, obviously, because being a translator is a fine profession.
Yes, they're both very noble pursuits, I would say. So different skills required, and I do find when I translate, there's a lot of things that I fall down on because of perhaps I'm more of an interpreter than a translator, and so I have to make more of a conscious effort to be a bit more thorough, I would say, certainly with regards to proofing my own work. That's something that I do fall down on a bit.
Yeah, that I can absolutely relate to, because I don't do lots of translation right now, but I used to do. And I like doing it, but it seemed more of an effort for interpreters, I think. I don't know if everybody feels like that, but you seem to, in terms of thoroughness, that's what you said. But I think that the two actually go together very well, because sometimes we as interpreters can use the thoroughness of a translator. And sometimes the other way around, as when we do translation, we can use the spontaneity and maybe the sort of the linguistic flexibility that an interpreter has. So I think the two actually go together very well.
Yes, I completely agree. I think that's the best approach, to try and borrow some aspects of each profession and try and come up with something that works for you. Absolutely.
Yeah. So you said there that sometimes you don't introduce yourself as a sports commentator because you don't want to talk shop. I mean, we all know for every match that's on TV, there are as many commentators as there are viewers, and everybody has an opinion, and everybody thinks that they would actually make for a better commentator than the one that's on TV or on the radio or whatever. So I'm interested in how you actually became a football commentator. I mean, aside from the fact that you love football.
Yeah, well, it's something that I wanted to do since I was 15, really. I just found that when I was playing, not when I was playing myself, but when I was playing computer games with my friends and we were playing football, I just tended to commentate over the matches, and I've always been quite vocal, to be honest, sometimes to a fault.
That's interesting.
And just the idea came to me, and I used to watch a lot of matches, and I thought, oh, I'd love to do that. And it was when I said that, I think to my parents particularly, it was met with a sort of... indifference, really. They didn't really know what to say, and at that time I didn't think you could even train to be a commentator per se, but I understand now from a lot of my colleagues that there are specific broadcast journalism degrees, and specifically sports, where you can get into the profession that way, which I know for a long time wasn't the case. It was it was more a case of being a sports journalist, starting out in the written press and then perhaps moving to radio and going like that, a more conventional route. So I looked at first doing it when I was at university doing my bachelor's degree in French and Italian, and I saw an advertisement from the BBC, who in partnership with the RNIB, it's the British Royal National Institute of the Blind, they were looking for more representation at football clubs, because there was a reasonably large number of, relatively speaking, of blind and partially sighted as they were then known. I think there's now a more politically correct term for that, but we'll gloss over that, who were going to football grounds and whose friend or family member were then describing the action for them. So it was actually technically termed as audio description, which is which I know is a big market that's coming into practice as well on TV in the UK. And so they teamed up, the BBC and the RNIB, and they got government funding, and I went to a couple of workshops on how to be not just a radio commentator, a match day audio describer, because there's a slight difference. When you're on the radio, there is a tendency that you'll then go to another ground for a goal update, or perhaps you'll talk about something else. But these were specifically supporters within the ground, as was I, and the idea was to describe the action very specifically, where the ball was, and so on and so forth. So that's how I got into it, and after that, I was promised a role at a football club, a voluntary role, which never came to pass, not once but twice. So I went away on my year abroad. Came back, did the same workshop again, was promised another football club. Didn't happen, and then I went away again, as us linguists tend to do. And when I came back to do my master's in 2011, I knew I was going to be in the UK for at least 9 months. So I thought, well, let's give it one more go.
Yeah.
And I contacted the local football club, which for me was Bristol City, and I started on the hospital radio. And a few months later, a job came up in London. They were looking for French and Italian commentators. And I was slightly wary about doing it in a foreign language, but I thought I'd apply. And at that time, despite the fact it's London and there are huge swathes of native French and Italian speakers, my boss at that time hadn't found too many people, and my commentary background helped me on that. And it went from there, which I have to say really helped me as an interpreter, and especially as I now work actively with my French and Italian. It really helped me to improve those spoken skills in public. And
I was just going to ask about that, because you mentioned a bit early on that in history that there wasn't necessarily a workshop or study that you could do to become a commentator, but you would sort of develop from being a sports journalist. But of course, it involves other skills such as speaking and describing and so on and so forth. So would you think that the commentating and the interpreting help each other?
I think they were hugely complementary. Yeah, absolutely. I started doing it. It was quite tough for 6 months, just time wise, because I was at Bath during the week. Working pretty much, I was working 9 to 5 at least, because I was doing a master's and I'd given up full-time work to do the master's. So I tried to take the same approach. And then on the weekend, I would go down to London to do the commentary. And at that time, right at the start, I was doing, which is probably not advisable, regardless of what language you're doing it. But I would often do 3 games on a Saturday and 3 games on a Sunday, which is a lot, really. I think it's too much. But at that time, you're happy to get the experience, obviously, to get the money. And so I was traveling down on a train from Bath to London. It would take 3 hours door to door to get to work. I'd work from midday until about 10 o'clock on a Saturday. Luckily, I had family in the local area. I stayed with them. I'd work a similar length of time on the Sunday. I'd get the 10 p.m. train back to Bath on the Sunday, be home for 1, and then get up at 7 again to go to Bath. So it was exhausting, to be honest, but I think it was very worthwhile for a number of reasons. A, because it allowed me to get a lot of exposure speaking French and Italian in a more formal context. I mean, I'd spoken it, obviously, having lived in both places, but broadcasting is different because you have to choose your words carefully, you have to enunciate, you have to describe the action. And I think a lot of that helped me then when I went into... I should just add that I don't technically have a French or an Italian B. Institutionally, it's what I call it's what I call a football B. I wouldn't work into French or Italian on any other subject matter for the moment. I'm looking at doing it one day with Italian.
But that's exactly the point, right? Because it's such a I'm not saying a closed universe, but it's a very specific topic. It's a very specific jargon, if you will.
Exactly.
So I think it's probably feasible in such a specific case. Yeah.
Yes, and so I found that was very useful, because And quite rightly, everything I was hearing during my studies at Bath, and I have to say, everything I learned there was fantastic, and it's helped me immensely. And I know Bath have an excellent record of producing fine interpreters. But everything I was hearing there, quite rightly, in terms of the institutions, was only work into your A language. None of you guys have a B language. If you do want a B, it's going to take you years to develop. All of which I agree with. But it was good because I was getting exposure working into French and Italian. And also in quite intimidating circumstances, because there then came a time when I had colleagues who were native speakers who were also commentating, and when they weren't commentating, they tended to sit or stand behind me, and you knew that they were listening to you. So you had to get things right, and that obviously helps then when you sit at the top table and you're interpreting into French or Italian. And I'm not naive to think that everything I say is going to be word perfect, but I think as long as you have a reasonably authentic accent, and as long as you aren't making grammatical mistakes every single sentence, I think the odd, particularly with French and Italian, I think the odd gender slip is okay. Not too many, of course, but it's difficult because I love football, and if I were to strictly go on what is my A language and only work into my A language, I would never work in football. So I think you do have to be a little bit more realistic about what can and can't be done, because as you said, it's quite specific. It's quite a specific niche, in that a press conference will last maximum 40 minutes. You might do two on the day, and they're not going to, for a question of cost and on the basis of just logistically, they're not going to hire two interpreters. It doesn't make sense. So you have to work both ways. And I would also suggest that there aren't too many fully trained and qualified interpreters who legitimately have a B language, who are bi-active, who are working on the football market. And also, as you know, Alex, there's a lot of people working on the private market whose B, or whose second language, active language, if you will, is only on their own say-so, because perhaps they don't work for the institution, so there is no official test to do. So I think all of those things meant that eventually, having done what was then probably 18 months of commentary before I did my first press conference, it helped me immensely when you're having to talk on air in French or in Italian for 90 minutes. So the two for me, almost by accident rather than design, really, really helped me in what I'm doing now.
And I would assume that because you refer to being, you know, precise in terms of grammar and everything, I think it's much more important than in normal interpreting, as it were, to bring across the feel of the match, I think, or the atmosphere in the stadium and that kind of thing, or how the match evolves.
Yeah.
That it's maybe not that important that you get every gender correct or whatever.
Absolutely. And I think the tactical understanding is important depending on where you're working and with whom you're working. With the English media, they don't tend to ask too many questions about tactics, but certainly when you go abroad, when you go to Italy, for example, there will be a lot of questions about tactics, and there are very specific terms about positions. And obviously in this job, we do have to study up for a lot of assignments. And yes, you can learn terminology and you can learn jargon, but I think you do need to understand the game as well, as opposed to just learning glossaries before a press conference. You might be able to get away with it for a few, but depending on what the game is, the importance of the game, and if there's some specific tactical tweak that's gone on, I think if you're not familiar with football, you might struggle with that somewhat. So I think the football knowledge is important as well, I would say.
Yeah, it's what they call the reading the match. Or,
yeah, exactly.
So we're going to talk about preparation later on, because that's really interesting to me. For now, insofar as you can say, are there big differences in the football language or football culture between, let's say, the UK, Italy and Portugal, so that the cultures you know best, I presume?
Yeah.
In terms of jargon, or what people want to hear from a commentator, from a press conference?
Okay, on the interpreting side, I think you need to have the specifics. Certainly in Italy, they probably have a dozen different words for the various roles in midfield, which in England we probably wouldn't have. So you end up having to come up with quite long equivalents, really. They have a word, regista, which means director. It's literally a film director, which in English I always say is deep-lying playmaker, which is a lot longer, if you will. So there's a lot of roles like that. So in terms of the interpreting side, yeah, you do need to have an understanding of the specific positions. I don't yet work with Portuguese, but in European Portuguese, the positions have different names to the names that they have in Brazil, for example.
Of course they do.
naturally, just to make things even more complicated.
Exactly.
So when, on the interpreting side, yes, I think you do need to know all of the... all of the different positions, what they do, and specifically already have thought about how you're going to interpret them, have thought ahead about solutions, because it's one thing understanding regista, but the whole job is coming up with an equivalent then and there, which will make sense to your target audience. And that's not always easy. So I think if you've already thought about how you're going to deal with certain things that might come up, a lot of it is anticipation. I think that's true in interpreting in general.
Yeah.
As for the commentary side of things, a lot of it depends on what direction you're given from your employers. I haven't been given too much direction in my current job. I'm working for Benfica, for BTV, the club channel.
Mm-hmm.
Naturally, there is a tendency to have a certain... bias or partiality towards Benfica because I'm working for them,
of course,
which helps because they win every week anyway, so it makes it a little easier.
Yeah.
But it depends, and that's quite unique really to the person that's watching you. Some people can't stand stats, some people expect you to come out with a whole list of numbers.
Yeah.
Other people just want you to say the names, some people expect you to analyse the game a bit more. So it really depends on what you're doing. I try and do all of those things rather evenly, and keeping in mind my role, which is to enhance the product and describe the action and not try and... there is a tendency to think that you're the main event, and that's not the case. And I think the interpreting actually helps on that.
Because it's the same idea, right? It's not about you.
Yeah, exactly. We're heard and we're not seen. And I really think if someone's doing their job properly, you shouldn't even notice there's interpretation there, which is probably unrealistic. But it's the same thing with a commentator. You should only really notice the commentator if they're doing a really good job and they're doing something right. I think if you do notice them, it's often for the wrong reasons, because they're annoying you with something they're saying or something they're doing. So, yeah, let the game run its course. Let the real entertainment do their job. So the players,
mm-hmm.
and if it's a dull game, that's when you need to be a bit more active on the commentary side. That's when you might throw in a stat or talk to your summariser or co-commentator and get their input, because nothing's happening on the pitch. So yeah, I think the interpreting helps on that aspect as well.
Yeah. But I think being an interpreter also is an advantage, because you actually get the names right. That's a pet peeve of mine with German commentators in particular, that sometimes they really don't get the names right. I don't know if that's annoying to the normal spectator, but if you know how the names are supposed to be pronounced, that can be quite annoying, I think.
Yes, well, this is something I've been discussing with some colleagues over the last few days, in fact, because one of my colleagues, my commentary colleagues, has come up with a very good idea of having the clubs produce audio files with the player saying their own name at the start of every season. There's a sort of style guide, if you will, for the commentators. I'm not sure whether it will happen, but it's a very good idea, because a lot of times there are discrepancies between how the name should be pronounced, what the commentator is saying, but then there's the risk of sounding pretentious if you overly authentic, if you will, on your names.
Mm.
Do you say Cristiano Ronaldo, or do you say Cristiano Ronaldo?
Yeah.
You know, where do you go with that? Things like that. So it's difficult. So I think you have to anglicize to a certain extent, but also try and at least mirror what would be the authentic pronunciation. But I was having a discussion on Twitter earlier this morning about a French player who's from Alsace,
mm-hmm.
and in German it would be Schneiderlin, but in French it's Schneiderlin. So,
of course.
And I think he would call himself Schneiderlin, and the commentator was arguing that because he's from Alsace. And he erroneously said that Alsace is a German-speaking region. The last time I checked, it's very much French-speaking in France.
Yes.
But as with a lot of these border regions, there's sort of checkered linguistic history. So so that's just one example. This is something that we have a think about quite a lot. But I think as long as you're consistent, I think if you decide on something and then you're consistent, I think that's all you can really ask for. So
yeah. So your current gig with Benfica, how does it work? I suppose there are a few more commentators, or do you just do it in English or other languages as well?
So I knew I was moving to Lisbon in March, and I came here for 3 days in January, and I'd heard, not rumours, but I'd heard from a colleague who's Australian, but he has Portuguese parents, that he thought the only English-speaking broadcasting job in Portugal was with Benfica doing their games in English. So I was keen to explore that because I was leaving Milan, where I was working as a commentator on Italian football in English. And although I wanted to move here to learn the language, I didn't really want to give up broadcasting in English. And I was concerned that if I then left it and wanted to get back into it, it might be a bit problematic. So I just turned up to the stadium in January. I didn't have an appointment or anything, asked at reception about Benfica TV, BTV as it's now known, and I got given a generic email address. I sent an email explaining who I am and what I do. I had an answer within a couple of hours. The next day I had a meeting, and then when I came out in March, the next day I started commentating. So I was quite fortunate on that.
Wow.
But that is because there aren't too many, as you might imagine, there aren't too many experienced commentators in English in Lisbon. So it's quite a small market in terms of that. In fact, the irony I will say is that I was doing a lot more broadcasting in Italian and French when I was in London, and the irony is I had to leave London to go to Milan to start broadcasting in English. I've been doing that with I originally started with two colleagues, one of whom now is covering football in Portuguese. They've got a couple of leagues this season, so there's me and a Portuguese colleague, and I think the dynamic works quite well because I do the main commentary, the lead commentary, so I describe the action and he is my summariser or co-commentator, which depending which term you want to use, and he will analyse the game, and I think that lends an air of authenticity as well. He's not a native English speaker. His English is very good. He has a slight accent because he's Portuguese, and I actually think that really makes for a good product because you can tell he's a local, you can tell he knows the league and the team very well, and we did that for the first time this season on Sunday the 16th, Sunday just gone. And it went very well. So I only do the home league games for Benfica, of which there are 17 a season. But it's great. I do it from the stadium, which is nice because in Milan it was all from a studio. So it's much nicer to do that. Unfortunately, for logistics and costs, there's a lot more studios are being used these days. But so that's good. I'm there in the press box and go to the game. And I do that really as a way to keep my hand in with the broadcasting, and in the global scheme of things, it's more pocket money than anything else. I do feel that I'm trying to juggle two distinct careers, and sometimes I feel like I'm not really focusing on either of them. But essentially, I moved from London to Milan to try and develop my commentary a bit more, and having spent 18 months there, I've moved here to try and work on my interpreting a bit more, in that I'm learning another language and I want to make myself a more attractive prospect as an interpreter by adding a third C. So it's nice to keep working in football whilst I'm here, but it is a case of I'm here more for interpreting, more for my own personal development as an interpreter than as a commentator per se. I think if I wanted to really focus on the commentary, the next move would have to be back to London, but it's not something I'm considering at this moment in time.
But you've been a freelancer all throughout, and the commentating is usually a freelance gig.
It is, yeah. I've been a freelancer throughout. When I first started commentary, I got my work through an agent, but I was still freelance. And Yeah, so I work as when I do my translation work, I'm freelance. When I do my commentary work, I'm freelance. And then I'm a freelancer at with the EU, and also when I do football press conferences. So yeah, it's nice. I actually think it means you end up working more than you would if you were just doing an office job or a staff job somewhere else. Because there is a tendency to take on as much work as possible and not take as much holiday, because I'm still bogged down with the notion that when I go on holiday, I'm paying for it twice, because I'm not working and I'm paying for my holiday. So I think I need to get over that sooner or later and start being a bit better to myself from that perspective. But yeah, I've always been freelance, and I do feel quite lucky in that I feel I was able to even consider a career as an interpreter because of the fact that, having done 6 months of commentary before I graduated from my master's, it meant that I had a job to go into in London, whereas I had a lot of my classmates who just qualified then. Those that didn't pass the test for the UN or the EU have pretty much fallen out of the profession, apart from a couple of colleagues who work for Copacabana in Brussels, but that's because they have staff jobs. So I think that is an issue there, that there's not much freelance work to get your hands on when you've just qualified and you're trying to get experience. So I was fortunate in that I could do other work, commentary, whilst I gradually started to pick up more work. And
So for your time in Portugal, have you given yourself sort of a set amount of time for getting to a certain level, or how do you plan that?
It's tricky. I do like to plan things, and I think it's important to have goals and milestones, but I find it quite hard on myself. I've now done three formal language courses, but it's quite hard to get your head around as an interpreter, because everyone here talks in terms of the various European common framework reference, which I think is almost irrelevant in our profession, because I think being an interpreter implies that you go well beyond what their highest thing is, which is C2.
It's not very useful for us.
Exactly. So I'm working my way through that to begin with. I think I might do the C2 exam next year, in March, having been here a year, just for my own, just to see where I am formally, if you will. But yeah, it's nice having the football to work with, because I'm able to read the sports press every day as part of my work for Benfica. I like to keep informed on that. I could already read a lot before I even started learning Portuguese, thanks to Italian and French, and I found that those languages are helping a lot. And also, just being an interpreter has helped a lot. It's the first time I've learnt a language since I've been a qualified interpreter. I just find you have much more acute listening skills, better analytical skills. You're able to figure out a lot more of what's being said from the context, and all of these things have helped. But yeah, I think the time frame I'm putting on it is I want to sort of take it step by step. The next step I want to do is start doing translations from audios, which the agency I work for do some of that. So from football, then I eventually want to start doing some written translations from Portuguese, again on football, and eventually I would like to do I'm not sure which stage will come after that, whether it would be a case of trying to formally add it with the EU and taking a test with Portuguese, or whether I would try and attempt a press conference. But attempting a press conference would mean working actively into Portuguese, so I think it's going to be quite a long process, but I want to at least have some intermediate steps so that I can see that I've made progress, and it's not just a big daunting challenge. Start from scratch, see there, because there are times when you think, oh, okay, I've made real progress, I'm coming along very nicely, and then you think back to the amount of time you spent learning your existing languages and how long it took you to really get to a level where you could work with those, and then it becomes, then you really start to grasp the enormity of the task. So I haven't put a time frame on it. I think realistically, to be able to take the test at the EU to add it, I would like to think 3 years from when I started here, which is March, and I think that's doable because I'm here. I think I'm lucky with my work that I'm able to translate from home, so I'm able to spend time here. I'm amazed at some colleagues who are able to add languages in a very short space of time, learning whilst not being in the country, still having full-time jobs and families, etc. And then going and spending a month or two at the end of their time before adding, I find that blows my mind, because I certainly couldn't do that personally. But yeah, I think this might be it for me, though, language wise I'd much rather have and I looked at you on the famous Trombinoscope as well, Alex, and
which is the internal list of colleagues in the European Commission Interpreting Service, just for those who don't know.
Absolutely. And I noticed that you have an English retour, but I noticed you didn't have six or seven C's as a lot of colleagues that we work with have. And personally, I'd much rather have, I think it's a personal preference, personal taste, but I would rather work with three languages, and ideally I'd love to work actively into all of them with football, and perhaps one day add Italian as a B for the institutions, but that will be after I've worked on my Portuguese, than trying to have four or five C's, which I think is incredible, but I think it would take so much maintenance, and I think ultimately at least with your spoken skills, it does tend to do some damage to how well you can really express yourself in those languages when you're not working. I might be wrong on that, but I have spoken to colleagues who have said that just by virtue of adding and learning more languages, that you can't dedicate as much time to the languages you start with. So I'd like to keep my French and Italian strong, and hopefully add Portuguese to a level where I'm happy with. But again, that's better's choice, shall we say?
Yeah, that sounds like a very good plan. Did you do the same about becoming an interpreter? Because you said that you basically knew you wanted to be a sports commentator, but you still decided to. I think you have a BA in French and Italian from London University College, and then went on to University of Bath. Why?
Why? It's a good question. It actually came about from a very awkward, embarrassing experience, an interpreting experience, funnily enough. Now, I left UCL in 2008. I graduated in 2008. But to be honest, I was a little bit embarrassed with my level of spoken, particularly French, but also Italian. So I didn't like telling people I had a degree in languages, and then felt a little bit undermined by other people I knew that spoke three languages and had a degree in engineering or economics, which is a lot of these people weren't English people. Mm-hmm. That's not to make a generalization, but well, you can interpret it how you will. Anyway,
yeah.
So I wanted to improve upon those languages. I didn't have anything clear in my mind about what I wanted to do, so I went and spent a year in the south of Italy teaching English, and then I did likewise in the south of France. Mm-hmm. And I felt that gave me much stronger languages.
And it also explains why you actually understand Laurent Blanc, which I find amazing. I saw that in one of your videos. So chapeau.
Thank you very much. Yeah, no, I like him as a speaker, actually. He's a very nice man as well. But
he is, yeah. But he's difficult to understand, I find.
Yes, yeah, he's better than some of the others. There's the worst one I did was the coach of Montpellier at the time, who was René Girard, and he was awful, real southern accent, but more from the west, more from the southwest, and used a lot of his own expressions, a bit of a sort of unique idiolect there. So I think in some ways you'd be better off with a French mother tongue doing René into English than actually an English mother tongue, which just shows that occasionally, you know, it's quite good to work into a foreign language. To get back to what you were saying, so I spent a year in Brindisi in the south of Italy, and then in Avignon in the south of France, and it was when I was in Brindisi that I did a friend of mine who was part of a fair trade organization, they had an Indian gentleman coming to speak to them about artisanal wooden toys. And he was speaking English, and they asked if I would interpret, and I had no idea what it was about. And I didn't have a notepad or pen. Mm-hmm. He had a very thick Indian accent, so I was struggling to understand that as it was. And my active Italian was in no condition at all to be able to deal with that. And it was bizarre. I sort of gave up halfway through, and I gave up because there was someone in the audience who essentially was doing my job for me, who was an Italian speaker. And I wondered why it was so much easier for a native Italian to do it rather than me. And it's only years later, when I then studied it, that I realized, of course, it's going to be much easier to understand and express something in your own language than it is to do it the other way around. So that was a negative experience, and I was embarrassed. I walked out of the room, and anyway, that was in the year in Brindisi. A year later, when I was living in Avignon, I went back to Brindisi and saw said friend and was discussing what I wanted to do, because I was thinking about moving to Brazil to teach English again. But then my dad quite rightly pointed out, he said, "Oh, so you want to be an English teacher?" I said, "Oh, God, no." And he said, "So why are you about to embark on a third consecutive year as an English teacher?" I said, "Okay, that's a good point." He said, "See if there's something else you want to do. If not, go to Brazil." So I discussed it with the friend who'd essentially hired me for this interpreting thing the year before and had vouched for me with his friends. And he said, "Well, have you thought about working for the EU? And we researched it. And to be an interpreter, I saw that you needed an interpreting master's ideally, or proven experience in the industry, which I didn't have. And then we looked at the small number of institutions that offer it in the UK. And I think only Bath at that time, it was probably about February, only Bath still had their applications open."
Yeah.
And so I applied, and it went from there. So it was by chance, really. And then when I started the masters, I realized that I loved it immediately. And I did find that the 2 years between my BA and my masters helped immensely with my understanding of the two languages. I still had some incredible colleagues who went straight from their undergraduate degree to doing the masters and then qualified for the institution, which again blows my mind, because I would have had no chance of doing that whatsoever. But certainly for me personally, it was important to have 9 months of exposure of those two languages before doing the masters, because it helped a lot more, just the sheer contact hours with the language. So
yeah,
it went from there.
Great. I want to talk about one specific thing which you alluded to a bit earlier, which is preparation. And I found that interesting because you tweeted a photo a couple of days ago, I think, about how you prepare for a match commentary, I suppose. I'll put the photo in the blog post so people can see it, but maybe you can, I don't know if you have the photo there, if you just remember what the table looked like. So there are post-it notes, a few magazines, I suppose. Can you just run us through the what the match preparation looks like, and then maybe, I don't know if you can compare it to how you would prepare for an interpreting job? Or
yeah, it's everyone has their own different ways of of preparing. My colleagues who I commentate with as well, they all have their own different ways. I'm quite visual, and I find that post-it notes are quite useful, because depending on the way that the team actually play their formation, you can then rearrange the players on the pitch, and when there are substitutions, you can just post someone over the top. I have other colleagues who use stickers and so on and so forth. I didn't always do that. It takes a bit more time, but I'm quite visual, and I tend to have 3 or 4 one-liners about each player, be it a statistic or something they've said in the media, or if they have a particular history against the club that they're playing against on that day, whether they've scored in the past. And it's just a case of going to that line when the camera pans in on that player, or when there is a quiet moment in the game.
So basically every post-it note is a player and a few bits of info about
yes,
that player.
Exactly. Okay. I have that for both teams, and then I have on the right-hand side of my big bit of cardboard, I have which I have 2 bits of cardboard for each team. I have some other more generic stats about the form of the team in question, if the manager said anything, if there's been some big changes, and in terms of the club, quite an interesting time at Benfica at the moment with changes in the management. So just things to to jog my memory, really, as opposed to anything else. And I find just by writing this all out formally, a lot of it is already absorbed before you even do the commentary. So often, if it's a good match, I'll only glance down at it, which can be a bit demoralizing when you realize it takes hours to do, but it's nice. It's more of a crutch than anything else, which I think differs from the interpreting prep.
During a match, if you're really in the flow, you don't really need all that stuff.
No,
but it's still good to have done it and have prepared it before.
It's good to have it, absolutely. And when you're doing the same team every week, you do imagine that people will be familiar with that team. I do Benfica every week, and you don't really need to spend too much time talking about who they've played for in the past, where they're from, their age, etc. It's more topical things about them, their form, how many goals they've got this season, and so on and so forth. But I think it is different to the interpreting preparation. And I have to say, I think that's the thing I struggle with most with interpreting, is the preparation. Knowing what to do, how to do it, how much time to spend. I still feel I'm trying to find my feet with that.
Because the problem is you can always go deeper and you can always read more and learn more, but you don't know if it's really necessary or if it's even helpful.
Exactly. And I'm not a big glossary compiler, and that's something I need to get better at. But I have to say, and this might be my short-term memory, but every time I've compiled a glossary, how many times I read through it, the first time I hear one of the words come up that I've prepared, I can never get to it straight away, I have to say.
Probably happens to everyone.
Yeah, it's something I definitely need to work on, because it sort of defeats the whole object of preparing the glossary. But yeah. You might get it a sentence later, so you can fill it in. But
Or help the colleague.
Yes, exactly. So that can be of frustration. But I would love to hear more. I was saying this to you the other day. I'd love to hear more about other colleagues' experience, A, of adding languages, and B, with regards to preparation, because I do still feel that I'm very much finding my feet with regards to interpreting for the institutions. I know how to prepare for a football press conference, but if I've got a meeting on quite a specific subject matter, then I will always read the documents thoroughly and then I'll Google around that. But is there one thing that I should be doing more of? Is there something I should be doing less of? Is there one crucial thing to do? So I think that I find preparation for a football assignment much easier than preparation for an interpreting assignment.
Yeah, but I think we could all benefit from a bit more exchange on how people go about it. I mean, there's no silver bullet that works for everyone, obviously, but I think it will be interesting nonetheless to see how other people do it and what works for them. That's true. I'm interested, maybe as one of the final questions, in how the dynamics work between you and the co-commentator. Would you say it's a bit similar to having a colleague in the booth?
It is.
Because if you have a Portuguese co-commentator, as you said earlier, you don't talk at the same time. I mean, it would be similar as in an interpreting booth. Is that right?
Yes, it is, in that you almost take turns on mic. But I suppose the big difference is that both of our mics are on at all times when the game is going on. It's not a case of turning it on and off. And occasionally you might just talk over one another at the start of a sentence. But that comes with working with a colleague more. You get to instinctively understand when they're about to intervene. And there are certain rules, unwritten rules, if you will. If I describe the action and then we have a replay, typically I'll leave the replay to my co-commentator. I'll ask my co-commentator a question, and naturally you'd expect a reply to that. And when the ball is in certain areas of the pitch, he will come in and start saying things. But you also have to be quite ruthless in interrupting them. Because my job is to describe the action, and if I see that a chance is about to happen, it's my duty to describe what is happening on the pitch, even if my colleague is in the middle of a point. So we had that a couple of times on the Sunday, and I think that comes perhaps with not being a native speaker. It takes you a little bit longer to put your point across. So that's one thing. But certainly, yeah, we help each other. I've worked with colleagues before where they'll just write down a note to me whilst I'm broadcasting and you glance across, much like you would do in the booth with someone writing a word or a number for you, and of course you keep doing what you're doing, you're focused on what you're doing, but you're able to read what they're saying and take that on board. So I think, yeah, there are skills definitely that that overlap between the two professions. So much like you would do with a colleague when you're interpreting, occasionally I'll be saying something, I'll be mid-sentence broadcasting, and my colleague will write down, be it a statistic or just say, look what's on screen, or if they've spotted something to mention, and then you can do that. And much like the skills you develop when you're interpreting, you're able to keep your train of thought, finish your sentence, but also take on board what your colleague is saying to you, if it's a number they're suggesting, or perhaps a word you've used, a certain solution they've thought of a better or an alternative solution. So I think there are skills that transfer between the two, and I haven't had too much experience of it, only once thus far, but I think simultaneous interpreting really helps with regards to having one thing in your ear and saying something else. At least with that, though, you are saying the same thing, essentially. With the differences, but I think it's going to be a skill that will help me when I'm hopefully one day doing more high profile games with a producer in my ear, which I can imagine is quite difficult when you first start, but that's unique to television, I suppose, where you are commentating, you've got the producer in your ear saying, we're cutting to this, say something about this, and you still have to keep saying your sentence whilst listening to that. So I think those skills hopefully will help me one day, and we're lucky in that what we're hearing is what we're then saying, albeit with a slight delay. So there are definitely skills that overlap, and I think the two professions in a number of ways are complementary.
Yeah. So I have one final question, which is a terminological question, I guess, because for the kids that come out with the players at the beginning of the match, when everything starts, we have a very funny word in German, which is Auflaufkinder, and Auflauf also is the word for a gratin, I suppose the French word is, so something with cheese on top, which is a nice double entendre. I was just wondering if there's a similarly funny term in English or in any of the other languages, insofar as you can tell.
Not that I'm aware of. I need to check that one, actually. In English, we just call them...
The kids that come onto the pitch, I guess.
Yeah, I think they are, because they're not mascots, because we have mascots that wear that wear those big costumes. I'm not even sure what we call those in English. You've put me on the spot there, and in typical style, I've not come up with the solution. So sort of undermined myself there.
Sorry, I didn't mean to put you on the spot there.
No, that's very interesting. I'll have to look at that. But in English, I think we might call them mascots, but then I think that's probably a word that would cover two things, which would cover both the man in the strange yes. animal costume, and also the kid coming out with the ball or the referee.
Do you know where the tradition comes from? Because I've always wondered. I mean, it's a nice gesture, obviously, for the kids, and they're probably fans or locals. But do you know where it comes from or when it started?
No, I'm not sure, to be honest. I think it's probably a way of rewarding a supporter and trying to get younger people coming to the ground. And I probably think it's a way of showing the human side of football as well. But yeah, it's really developed. It's evolved. Initially, it used to be one child that would go out onto the pitch and would be there. And now in international and European games, you have one kid per player who then they hold hands with the players. So I don't see anything wrong with it. But
I was just curious.
Yeah, it's definitely unique. I'm not sure they do it in any other sport. So there you have it.
Okay, thank you very much, Patrick, and thanks everyone for listening.